Hello everybody, it's my pleasure to welcome all of you to the symposium we have here this afternoon on spirituality in palliative care. My name is Klaus Baumann, I come from Freiburg University in Germany, from the Faculty of Theology, and it's my pleasure to chair this symposium, and I want to immediately pass the word to Bernard Chase as the first speaker. We agreed that we have a 15-minute presentation and then 5 minutes for questions, and then as we have 4 speakers we try to get through and to use the time we have. Please feel free then also to ask your questions to Bernard and the others who will present. So Bernard,
okay, thank
floor.
You. Good afternoon. So I'm Bernard Chase. I'm a clinical psychologist and a psychotherapist, and I work in oncology. I was responsible for developing the oncology, psycho-oncology services in Malta and the Abbott Hospital. I'm going to be presenting my model of spirituality, where there is the use of self. Okay? This is a self between psychotherapy and religion and spirituality. However, I think this is very relevant to people who are not psychologists and psychotherapists, actually. This is relevant to everyone who is a care worker with people who are dying or with the bereaved. Basically, it's developing myself to work with people. Now, I want to start off with the concept of the wounded healer. I don't know if you're familiar with this concept. Jung talks about it, and he says it is only the wounded physician who heals. And what he means by that is that we are all wounded. You and I are wounded. Now, for me to be very effective in working with people who are dying and with the bereaved, when we're actually talking about what is the most life and death, the most important things in our life, in our existence, then I have to be very, very aware of my own wounds. Many of us want to keep a distance. I think Christina spoke about that. Just to protect ourselves. Why? Because when I'm working with someone who's dying, it's going to bring up issues of my mortality. Is everyone hearing me? It's going to bring up issues of my mortality. It's going to bring up issues of my hurts. Now, if I do this, I don't have to address my wounds. But if I want to be effective in this relationship, then, and I want to heal through my presence, then I have to look at my own wounds. And in fact, it is only the practitioner who is committed to her own inner work that can actually heal. No one who is a Catholic writer, Catholic priest, talks about how we use our wounds, and he says, just like Jesus, he who proclaims liberation is called not only to care for his own wounds and the wounds of others, but also makes his wounds into a major source of healing power. And this is very, very important. So when I come next to you, I am going to be who I am, and I am going to be what I am, and use my own wounds and use my own hurts to be able to reach out to you. Now, obviously, this must not mean that I have to laden you with my hurts. Okay? We don't. As practitioners, we don't tell our patients, listen, let me tell you what's happened to me or what. But that I am aware of it, that I'm committed to working on myself so that I can use those wounds to actually heal. Now, my model is based on the Gestalt model, the Gestalt contact cycle. I'm just going to go through this briefly. It is a cycle. Gestalt therapy is a therapy which emphasizes a lot on growth. Okay? And mine is a growth-focused model. Growth of practitioner and growth of client. Now, I'm just going to go briefly through the Gestalt cycle because it is the basis of my work. So, we have a sensation. So, I'm talking to someone, I'm watching a film, and there is a sadness. Now, I can do this. I can become aware of the sadness. I can be mobilized to let it out. I can make contact with it. I can embrace it, cry, think about it, whatever, until it subsides. And I withdraw. So I'm ready for another figure to come up. However, if at any point, pathology happens when at any point in that cycle, I break the cycle. So if I am feeling the sadness and I say, no, no, I mustn't feel it, so repress it. So the energy is taken to repress rather than to go through it and to grow. Okay, and psychotherapy helps this, helps people go through the cycles. Now, I have, my model has two cycles, the practitioner and the client. So what I'm saying is, in our spiritual journey with the client, we both grow. Both the practitioner and both the client grows. So there's the practitioner and the client, and there is, so it emphasizes the relationship and the growth of both. And it also includes two other realities which are very, essential in dying and bereavement. We've got the interpersonal cycle and we have the cultural cycle. So when I'm talking about growth for the client, and I'm going to talk about the interpersonal and the cultural, I am also saying that the practitioner needs to address this in his or her own life, because we cannot be authentic then. So I want to start off with the interpersonal relationships. Now, I don't know whether it's the same in your country, but in Malta there's a lot of taboo about talking about dying. Thank God we're managing to work on this. People don't want to talk to their relatives about dying because they want to protect them. The relatives don't talk, the patient does not talk to the relative, the relatives don't talk to the patient, so everyone's nice and isolated and going through it. However, there are important things that need to be said when someone is dying. So Biok talks about five important things that need to be said, because he says relationships are not severed, but they are completed. So Biok talks about the importance of saying, forgive me, Ma, forgive me for the time in my adolescence when I gave you a lot of trouble. I forgive you for maybe when you weren't there, when I needed you. So I forgive you, Mom. Thank you for making me who I am. Thank you for giving me life. Thank you for giving me joy. Thank you for your modeling. I love you, and I will always love you. And goodbye. Obviously, these are not said overnight. This is a journey. And the practitioner needs to be committed, maybe without a goodbye in our lives, but I need to be committed to live these in my life. Do I say thank you? Do I live the moment? Do I ask to be forgiven? If I can live it, then I can witness it. And in this model, the witnessing is more important than the actual saying. With these five things, I have in my doctorate, I have come up with this, God bless you. Now, this is very cultural, and I don't know whether it pertains to your cultures too. When I was young, it was very, very common for us to ask, not common, it was expected of us, to ask for blessings from our elders every time we left. So it would be, good night, Pa, bless me. Good night, and if I didn't, God help me. But it was beautiful because it was a way of the parents or the aunts or the grandparents bestowing blessings when they are no longer there to protect the person. And I am using this in my practice too. So last time I worked with, this woman who's dying in her family, and she blessed all her children with the laying of hands. And then I asked her mother-in-law to bless her. And it was so, so therapeutic. So in my practice here, I ask people to, even especially with young children. I'm not going to go into preparing young children for the death of their parent, because there's a lot there. But with young children, it is very, very important that there is this completion. Now, our culture, the Roman Catholic religion is the dominant tradition in our culture. I'm going really fast, I'm sorry. Now, it is the predominant influencing factor. It is the predominant meaning structure. And we know that when faced with dying and suffering, even people who have moved away from the religion will go back to the religion of their childhood. If in other cultures it is alien to talk about religion, in Malta it would be alien not to. So patients freely talk about religion and they expect practitioners to talk to them as well. So it is impossible not to include religion in areas of dying and bereavement. And it would be a loss because it is rich in rituals, symbols and metaphors. So it provides an array of shared images which serve as a background for the client and practitioner to embark on a journey of meaning making. So the model needs to address two areas. Wait, okay, this is important. Religion, which is the garb that spirituality wears when it is culturally articulated, can actually distort the insight of spirituality. Because I was listening to Cohen yesterday, and I was saying, he's not talking, or at least I didn't get it if he did, about the negative effect of religion. Here in Malta, we find it a lot. It can promote denial. Yes, I think he actually talked about that, but he didn't talk about it as denial. No, for sure, I'm going to be cured because I'm praying, and I know that if I pray, I'm going to be cured. That's what religion tells us. So I don't say my goodbyes, and I die distressed. I don't say goodbyes, and the children are left there. So I can feel the denial, anxiety, guilt. I know why God gave me sent me breast cancer, because I was unfaithful to my husband. So this is negative religion. So it can actually distort the insight of spirituality. So this is also nice. It is not so much that Catholicism gives death a meaning as that it believes death, which remains both pointless and unavoidable, has been overcome. And this I like. I'm not going to go very much into it, but in a way, it is what suffering. Now, whether you are religious or not, if you are going through any suffering, you can always overcome that because you grow through it. But you need to be committed to the growth. So the model needs to address two major areas. It needs to support, and I'm talking about Malta, but I'm sure this is relevant in all countries, to support clients who have a different meaning systems, or to facilitate the creation of a new meaning system, which is not the Roman Catholic one, and to address the religious beliefs in such a way as to facilitate growth rather than to stunt it. Now I'm going to go to figure three. So you've got the client and the practitioner, and what is happening then? Now the practitioner, these are Kubler-Ross's stages, I'm not going to go through it, but you know dying is a gritty journey, it's a painful journey, but if you know Kubler-Ross's stages, you've got acceptance at the end. So as early as the 1960s, Kubler-Ross recognized that you go through all the what we call negative feelings, denial, the depression, etc. But at the end, you can grow. There is the acceptance. But meanwhile, the therapist, on his or her part, needs to practice presence and inclusion. Now, these are psychotherapeutic words, and I'm just going to go through them briefly. Basically, in a situation where you cannot... 1 minute. Oh, my God. I'm not going to manage to do all this. Okay, this is very important. In a situation where you cannot teach skills, etc., what is important is my presence, who I am. Okay, I'm going to go quickly through this because this is the difference between my model. The red places, that is the space between withdrawal and sensation. Now, what I want to emphasize over there is that there are times when you're working with dying people when they are, when basically they could have accepted that they're dying, but dying doesn't happen yet. So there is that wilderness experience, which I call wilderness experience. And sometimes as therapists or practitioners, we are helpless in this situation. I think that the practitioner needs to have a very strong belief system to be able to stay with the client in the wilderness experience. So for some people, it could be a huge belief in the human potential, I know what helps me is my religious beliefs. To be able to stay with the helplessness and until something moves, until a new figure comes up. In fact, I think we are more like cogs, so we can be there together. One person moves and it moves the cog of the other, and we grow together. But what we need to be open to, we need to be open to the space which is between. It means it's not my agenda, it's not the client's agenda, but when we are together there, and I am fully present, then something else will happen between us. And that is, for me, is spirituality. It is not so much what I say, but it is who I am and how I am there with the client. And sometimes it might be me who moves when we are stuck in the wilderness experience. Sometimes it might be the client who moves and the cycle goes on. I'm sorry, that was really brief.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Ben, it was brief, but you gave probably a lot of stimuli for further questions. And yes, probably there are some questions. And may I start with a question? What is the wilderness experience? Maybe one or two sentences on the wilderness experience.
Okay. The wilderness experience is the place where you are stuck, where you feel helpless, and where you feel that you are not moving. And this is the being able to stay rather than run away, and this is why I need to work a lot on myself as a practitioner, so I can stay with that. Okay.
Thank you for your presentation. Questions?
Would you present yourself?
Oh, sorry. Christopher DeBono from Canada.
Okay.
Could you talk a little more, in terms of the goal of the Roman Catholic experience in Malta, I would suspect, but I might be wrong, that there's diversity within that experience among the saints. So I wasn't sure in your presentation was a bit bipolar in terms of this or that. I wonder what exploration within the tradition might look like.
Yes, and that is what the model proposes, that we do have. If I had more time, I'd go to the stages of faith. Yeah. But unfortunately, many people take it as face value. It's what we were taught us when we were young. So many people don't explore and don't develop. But that is the difference between spirituality and religious experience for me. So what the model proposes is that we explore this. And I explore it as it is for you, not for me. But I need to have explored it as a practitioner on my own. Does that help or not? Yes, there are many.
Sure.
There's a lot of diversity. But unfortunately, many of my clients are really stuck in the should and the shouldn't stuck in the lens. Yes?
What is good religion for you? I'm sorry, you, Kelly. What is good religion for you?
What is good religion for me?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, somebody who develops their... asks questions, maybe not getting the answers, is able to challenge, tries to find their own meaning, develop their own relationship with God, and uses discernment, sometimes even at the expense of going against what is right. Because what is told to us is what is right does not necessarily need to be what is right to me. So that can be very liberating. If you help clients go through that, it can be very liberating, especially when they're dying and the sort of guilt and fear of punishment. Okay?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Ben, thank you very much for that. It was very interesting. I'm Jackie Watts. I just wanted to ask you about, you know, those stages where you said there is an exchange about speaking to the dying person in a thankful way. Mm-hmm. Forgive me, and I forgive you, and so on. And at the end, you say goodbye. I've been working with a model developed by Dennis Klass, who is a US sociologist, and he works in grief and bereavement theory around continuing bonds. And it occurred to me that model extends the connectivity between the goodbye and the forever.
Yes.
And it's almost a continuum spiritual and biographical connection that is maintained.
Yes.
He's written a lot about this in different ways.
Yes, for sure.
So when I saw your goodbye, I thought, I've been reading a lot of his work recently, and I thought, well, you know what? It isn't quite like that necessarily. So just thought I'd mention that.
Yes. If I... can I just finish with a little story and something which I... Do I have time?
If you really want to finish.
It's, I wanted to tell it to you. And this is... I worked with a young couple before the wife died. And it was this. It was talking about it, saying goodbye. Mm-hmm. Saying. And then I kept working with the husband in bereavement for a year after. Mm-hmm. And he was in despair. He was... There were times when I just sat with him, almost helpless myself. Mm-hmm. But I just sat with his pain. And then one of the days he came and told me, Benna, you won't believe what happened. I said, tell me. He said, I went to the cemetery, I went to the workman because I wanted to put the name of my wife's name on the gravestone. Mm-hmm. He said, and I was really bad and I was desperately praying for my wife to send me a sign that she's there. And he said, do you know what happened? He said, the workman was hammering. And there was a name, I wanted a marker, Josephine. So can you imagine the name Josephine, J-O-S-E-P? Suddenly the P falls. And the workman starts swearing, this has never happened to me, this is very difficult and more difficult. Because since we're very religious, we swear a lot. And the P fell. And he said, oh my God, then I was left with Jose, J-O-C, and Jose had been her pet name for me.
Oh.
Now, this is what I mean about the sacredness of here. I could say, look, it's coincidence. But because, as a psychotherapist, I am more mm-hmm. of a new experience. Because I have religious convictions, I also know that there's the unexplained,
mm-hmm.
which I cannot. So I stayed with him. And that actually moved the crowd. Because individually, because we stayed with this, this is the between. Without the sacredness respected individually together, we moved on into deeper levels, and that is very important for the reason. And the beauty about it, that is why we grow too. People say, how do you do this work? And I say, I wouldn't do anything else, because while the planet is growing, I grow too. I grow every time.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's more growth when I need someone else. So that was the story. I think I'll stop here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the encouraging explanation, also giving food for thought, for further thought. While I have to encourage Marisa Jogimaina, you will present yourself.
Yes, I will present myself. Let me settle this. Noel, thank you. Okay, well, Noel, because it's the PowerPoint. I'm Marisa Jogimaina. I am a psychologist and I work in pediatric oncology. I also started the work as a psychologist in pediatrics, and I also work with adults in hematology. So I'm seeing two different patients, in a way, cohorts of patients, and they're very, very different. What I'm going to talk today is about my experience. I've been working in oncology for about 15 years now, since 2004, so that was 14 years. And throughout these years, I have had several times to meet patients who were diagnosed with cancer, and thank God they have the treatment and they move on. However, there were times when children died, and as a psychologist on the ward, I have to go from the time that they are diagnosed to the time they die. I go through the palliative care with them and also afterwards, bereavement. I'm going to explain my experience, not explain, I'm going to allow you to see my experience with this child. The purpose of this study The purpose of the study was that when I was doing literature review, I realized that there weren't many many people talking about their spiritual journey with children, because it's I kept on finding that it's very difficult to do such a journey, to write about such a journey. And I must tell you, I found it very difficult. I'm a clinical, I'm not a researcher, and I found this journey, reflecting and so on, was easy. But to write it and present it in a short presentation, I tell you, it was very difficult. So I'm going to allow also the pictures to talk. I'm going to go to the Gibbs reflection. There is description, thoughts and feelings, evaluation, analysis, conclusion, and action and plan. So, we are not human beings on a spiritual journey, but we are spiritual beings on a human journey. And this was my experience on this journey. Palliative care for children, I don't know if you're familiar with palliative care in children, is different from adults, because the care needs to embrace the whole family. We're not talking only about the child, but we're talking about the whole family, which includes also in Malta the parents, the grandparents, and the children and the siblings, and sometimes even the aunts. The length of time of palliative care requirement can be longer in children, because sometimes children take their treatment takes long, and sometimes somehow it can take 5-6 years. It can be a long process. Let me explain what I believe, what I am meaning by palliative care. By palliative care, I am meaning from the beginning, when they are diagnosed, it is a life-threatening illness. So we give them palliative care. However, when there is no cure, we start. It becomes a life-limiting illness. So there is a limitation. Life is going to limit. So palliative care will change a little, because while before it would be giving them treatment, taking care of all the symptoms, so on and so forth, when it becomes a life-limiting type of palliative care, it's going to be more symptom control and pain control, and understanding what their needs are, one, the family and the child. So there is also the development, emotional, physical and cognitive, is continuous in childhood, that affects communication. In what way? For example, in this case, the child was 3 years old when he was diagnosed. By the end, when he died, he was 8. You can appreciate how he developed through the years. So as a psychologist, I have to understand what was happening to this child, because although he was sick, but he was developing. And another thing, working with children who are who have cancer, even 2-year-olds, they become very, very much aware of what's happening around them. And as a psychologist, I must be, and the whole team, not just the psychologist, we must be very, very aware of that, because they have a certain wisdom that somehow their illness is teaching them. It's beautiful to see it in them, because it's amazing. They teach me all the time. Again, evidence-based underpinning practice is limited. The number of children requiring palliative care are small all over the world. In Malta, it's very small, because our ward is only 7 bedrooms. Thank God we don't have a lot of children who are diagnosed. We have between 15 to 20 a year. And the prognosis for children is very high. It's between 75-80% children survive childhood cancer. So we're talking about a very small portion of children. And so it's all over the world. It's not just in Malta. And again, there is not only the child that needs support, but also the family that needs constant support. When we are working with the children, we must support the parents, because it is the parents who are going to give more support to the child. They know their child. They can understand what their needs are and be... and tell us what their needs are. So it's so important to keep contact with the parents and see what's happening. So that's the family. The philosophy of pediatric palliative care is delivered within a partnership of caring, addressing the individual needs of the child and the family. We have to understand what the family needs are as well, because kids don't fight cancer alone, so it's very important. This is where I work. I work in Rainbow Ward, and these are some pictures of our wards. This is the playroom and the activities. This is one of the rooms where a bedroom. So they have all the things there as well. And this is our ward. Okay. So then now let me go a little bit in the case. The child was a three-year-old. He had surgery and chemotherapy. He had Wilms tumor. Wilms tumor is kidney tumor. Usually kidney tumor, it's only 7% who get kidney tumor. It's a very small percentage. However, and usually they survive. There's a good high percentage of survivors. However, this child was not so lucky. So he had to go to abroad, because we don't do surgery in Malta. So he had to go to surgery abroad, surgery and chemotherapy with the family. After a year, he had a relapse. Then he had further treatment. Then he got second relapse. In between, since he got the second relapse in Malta, because at 7 years old, they go for Holy Communion. He had his Holy Communion alone, a big church full of his friends from school, celebrating his first Holy Communion because he had his second relapse. So you can imagine how this child knows what's happening, and me understanding and all this in front of me and trying to understand how it is influencing this child. So there was that. Then there was again surgery, chemotherapy and radiotherapy, again going abroad. At the age of 7, they were given the news that the disease just came back and there was no cure. And this child lived for 13 months. It was these 13 months that really made me understand how working with children can really change you. I had the experience of in one year there were 6 children who died in 1 year, and for us that's a lot. However, during when those 6 children died, I didn't have the opportunity to reflect, to understand what was happening. It was so overwhelming because every family was different, with different spiritually, psychologically, that I was too overwhelmed to understand what was happening. When I was following James, somehow I said, I need to understand what's happening here because I need information. I need to understand. So I started reflecting more. I already said this, the family is many things to the child. So what I'm saying here is that it's so important to understand what the family values are, because they are going to influence how the child thinks. And for me, it was important to understand their values. In this case, there was a case where the mother was very, very religious, and the father was not religious at all. In fact, they were going through different crises spiritually and psychologically. The mother was religious and she was hanging on to any miracle that can happen. The father had lost a sister of 28 years, a year before the second relapse. So he was very angry at God. He didn't believe in God. So I was faced with this family, a mother who was very much believing and a father who didn't want to touch God. He didn't want even to know that God. So where was I in all this? And the questions I had to ask myself. Where to be with one mother, with one spouse and the other spouse, and to understand and to respect that father. So these were the emotions I had to go. These were difficulties that I encountered to uncover the perception of the illness. A father thought the perception of his illness was one thing, the child had another way, the mother had another way of the illness. So everyone was thinking different. So I had to understand their perceptions. The fear of the uncertainty around the illness, how each and every individual was expressing it. And along, I was going along. How was I expressing my fear of the illness? How much physical pain would there be? How would it be controlled? The fear of death. Each one of us have fear of death when we are in touch with death. I don't know if it's your experience, but my experience is every time I come in touch with someone dying, I come in touch with my own death. In the sense that I have to ask myself where I am. What does this mean? So how to communicate to the child that his death is near? Again, this was incredibly difficult. Why? Because the child was still doing very well. And the mother did not want to tell the child that he was dying. And this is a dilemma, because the child will start having symptoms, and it's so important to prepare him, so important to understand what his story is. Again, this was the struggle that we were having. Again, the denial, the not wanting to face the issue. The father wanted to tell the child that he was dying. So again, I was in between. What? How to go about it? Spiritual elements. I already mentioned it. How, they didn't want to let go the idea of that the child is not going to survive. He can survive. We can do something and he will survive. Search more and he will survive. Coming to terms with the death of their child, that took them ages. It took them until perhaps a month before he died. And I was struggling because myself and the doctor used to go to see them every week, because they prefer to be at home. So we were visiting, and I was seeing that the mother is still struggling to say that the child is doing fine, he doesn't need medication, he doesn't need morphine, he doesn't need... And I was seeing that he was in pain. The doctor was also seeing that he was in pain. And we actually had to do tests to show the parents that the disease is there and it's painful. So we have to do that. And again, we are going through disturbance, the family is going through disturbance, and I, as a healthcare worker, am going through disturbance as well, because I had to go all the time to ask myself, am I going overboard? Am I going beyond my boundaries? Am I doing things that I should step back and allow them? It's a continuous struggle. At least that's how I felt. So, the praying for a miracle, and the miracles, this mother went through everything if she could to bring a miracle. So, she took him to Lourdes, she took him to Padre Pio, and this is very much Maltese culture. She took him to a healer in Malta. She was trying really hard. Well, the father was not, so there was this ambiguity. And the issue of different spiritual stages and different spiritual journeys of the parents. I was in all the time with that struggle. How to be with the mother, how to be with the father, and how to be with the child. Why? Because at one point, the child, in the beginning, I used to do a lot of play therapy with him, and he was communicating. When things started to get worse and worse and worse, he started withdrawing. And for me, and for the doctors, we realized that death was coming, because that's how children do, more or less, most of them at least. And he kept on withdrawing and withdrawing. However, although he was not speaking, he was writing a lot of letters. So these are some of the things that, items such rosary beads. And you can see all the little things that he used to have. And this child would put them under his pillow. So they would save him and create a miracle. Padre Pio and the roses. Okay. The presence. You need to be present over there. Thoughts and feelings. I already mentioned some thoughts and feelings. It's a good thing, because I only have 1 minute.
I had feelings of anger. Yes, I did come in touch with anger, sadness, anxiety, denial, and helplessness. You just mentioned that. Later, I started to experience shame, guilt, and abandonment. Abandonment, shame, in the sense that I came in touch where I myself have children, and I was, this was my experience, as a person, as a human being, seeing these parents hurt so much in pain, you ask yourself, what's happening here? Why should they be so much? As a human person, it was shameful for me to watch and be healthy and go and have a drink with my friends, so on and so forth. I had to encounter that. And I had to encounter guilt as well, because seeing a child die, children are not supposed to die. So abandonment, sometimes I felt abandoned. Sometimes I said, where are you, God? What are you doing here? Where are you taking me? Confusion. My limitations, all the time I was feeling my limitations, all the time. And this was a parallel process of what was happening also in the family. So what was happening in the family? No control, no limitations. What's happening to me as well spiritually? I was in the struggle. Okay, so this is the diary this child did. This is a rosary bead that he really loved. This is some of his. This is a child who did not go a lot to school because he wrote in one piece. But if you can see here, it's Jesus. Here, James is asking Father Christmas. So this is the magical thinking of the child. He's asking Father Christmas to tell Jesus to take care of him. So he was going through Father Christmas to ask him, and he was used to the writing letters to Father Christmas because Christmas was coming, and as every children they write letters and wishes. So you could see the spiritual dilemma of this child, where there is this magical thinking that Father Christmas can help me come across to Jesus and save him. And I myself being there, and what do I do to him, this child? How can I help him? Because he had physical, not a lot, but psychological and spiritual, I could see it. And it's trying to help.
Conclusions?
Okay, so this is another letter. And here the child was at the stage where he realized that he was dying. So he said, I would like that I die when I am 10. Okay, 2 more years. And I would be asleep and wake up next to Jesus. So that gave me the understanding that this child is ready. He is ready. Okay, these are some of my thoughts. Dear God, you brought me here. I went to a retreat with this mother. She told me, please come with me for a retreat. Yesterday, Professor Koenig mentioned praying with the family. Well, I had to do that. But again, I was asking, am I going? Am I jumping the boundaries? What is my role? There was this struggle. So, I'm going to go through. Conclusion. There is the need for more organized psychological and spiritual support to the healthcare professionals. I think that's very important. We've been saying it all along. There is the need of an available spiritual director to help those health professionals who want to continue with their growth. Sometimes we don't find them. I had to search for a spiritual director. And the preparation of the child from the beginning to the end of the, from the beginning of the illness. Adversity can be the driving force of spiritual evolution in personal problems. Although this principle makes sense to people in the abstract, when someone is actually facing heavy adversity, like the death of a loved one, most people can find it hard to see the upside. So, I want to know if you will stand in the center of the fire with me and not shrink back. I want to know if you can sit with pain, mine and your own, without moving to hide it, or fade it, or fix it. I want to know if you can be with joy, mine or your own. If you can dance with wilderness and let the ecstasy fill you to the tips of your fingers and toes without cautioning us to be careful, be realistic, to remember the limitations of being human. And with this, I close. Because this is.
Marisa, thank you very much for sharing. And also for this connection with Benna's presentation.
Yes.
For
yes.
Costa was very much of this wilderness experience in it as well.
Yes, yes.
And I want to open the floor for further questions or comments.
Yeah.
Marisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm from Poland. And I would like to ask you about, do you have any special support for another children from the family? I mean, brothers?
Yes, yes, yes. I had to take care of the brother. Yes, yes, we do that as well, because you cannot leave them alone. Mm-hmm. Brothers are part of the system. Yes, 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 yes. In fact, I also follow, for example, there was a time when I had to go to the school because the teacher were finding it very difficult to handle a boy whose brother was dying. Somehow, if the mother is dying, it's not so difficult. But another boy, it was very difficult. So I had to go to school and do that, to give them support.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
Hi, I'm Lori from Canada, and I want to say thank you to both of you. What an incredible presentation you both have given, and I know there's more to follow you. I work pizza oncology, and I'm so grateful for wonderful people like you in the profession, because that really helps, and you can see as a nurse how the support really helps the family. You know, from an objective, from another healthcare professional.
Yes.
Just to say thank you.
Thank you. And I have to add that this was not a work I did on my own. We were a team, a multidisciplinary team, an interdisciplinary team. And we supported each other, and all of us had our own way, in a way, learned. Because we can't keep on working with these people unless we keep on growing.
Mm-hmm.
Psychologically and professionally and spiritually.
Sometimes you get so submerged that you don't see, but others see. And as an oncology nurse, working with peds fast is absolutely a gift from God, really. How you all support the families and all of us on the unit.
And I also believe that it has to be a call, because you can't do this work for, and the nurses are there, even the doctors. I believe it.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to give the presence, to be able to give, it is a call, like Christina said this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any more questions? Yeah?
Sure. You, Kelly, are the parents still together?
Yes. In fact, bereavement was beautiful.
Wow.
The bereavement was beautiful because the child towards the end, there was a lot of healing. The child died a very good death, in the sense that it was with dignity and without pain. And he always was in hospital for a few hours. And he died in hospital, and he came into hospital and he slept. And the mother told me, oh my goodness me, what was happening? I said, no. He slept and he died as he wanted to die. And she was so much at peace. Yes, they are still together. They're still in a different. But I told one of the things that I explain and encourage the couple is to respect each other where they are, spiritually, emotionally, because we can never be exactly the same. And that's the beauty of it.
Final question.
Jackie Watts, thank you for that. I wanted to ask you if you eventually did find a way to tell the child, tell Jamie that he was dying.
Yes, yes,
so
yes.
How
really
did you do that?
Okay, what I did, I was preparing the parents all the time. I did try to go myself. We did go as a doctor and as a gynecologist. But what happened, the parents were blocking us.
Yes.
They weren't ready yet. So that was 2 months after he got the diagnosis. Not the diagnosis, the relapse. So in the long run, the child knew all along that he was going to die since the beginning. Why? Because these children go into hospitals and they see others dying. So we know that children know. It's helping the parents sometimes to understand that the child knows. Then when I gave them books, I really gave them a lot of books. But to know it, to know. Then what I did, what we did, then the parents accepted. Oh, for us.
No, this is funny. Go on.
So we can laugh.
Okay. All right.
No, let's go.
Once. No, are you okay, Dana?
Okay, that's a comic relief, you see.
Yes, we did. So I accept my answer. Yes, we did. We managed. At least.
Marisa, thank you very much for sharing the truth. Yes. Okay. So
he wanted to stay at home, and he managed to do that. And then he died for a few. He only stayed for a few hours, and he died in very peaceful.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. Now it is Teresa Bugeja.
You need to learn how to pronounce that before I start.
Yes.
It's Bugeja.
Bugeja. Okay. Teresa Bugeja. You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So today I decided to talk about the healing power of forgiveness for more than one reason. I am a lecturer in this faculty and a psychotherapist, so I try to marry both, what I get from both fields. And what I get from students, I'm a lecturer in personal professional development, I do get a lot. But especially from the encounters I have in class and from what I read from their reflective diaries, because one mode of assessment is collecting a reflective diary, I do get a lot of void. Some of it is fertile void. I do get a lot of pain, and I do get a lot of no focus. So, like, imagine we're in class, and I'm trying to engage them, and they seem to be lost. And I always wondered why. And from the reflective diaries, I gather that there is abuse. There is pain of parents separating. There is a lot of no purpose in life, or still trying to find what their purpose is. And the underlying issue very often is low self-esteem, no self-confidence, and a lot. And from time to time, I do organize workshops in small groups, because we do get big groups. But in small groups, then I realized that this pain needs to be healed. And most of it is emotional pain. And there's so much literature on forgiveness that I decided for such a short span of time to focus on self-forgiveness. So for 30 seconds or so, I would like to guess from you what your understanding of forgiveness is. Just what comes to mind first, write it down or say with it. Yeah. But you are supposed to be thinking about your definition of forgiveness. Yeah. Okay, can I be in touch with some of your understandings?
Peace with self.
The problem. What else?
Letting go of past hurt.
We don't always know what the past hurt is. I suppose. And that's it. This is what was happening with my students. Very often they're hurt without knowing what the hurt is. And through the reflective diary, at least that gave them a space, that gave them a permission to sit back, think, and maybe identify what's blocking them. And thankfully to this diary, they come in touch and become more aware of what the blockage is. But then what to do with this blockage? Where do healing come in, etc.? Does anyone else want to say their understanding of forgiveness?
Very hard was immediately what came visceral level.
Very
hard.
What is hard?
Self forgiveness.
Very hard.
Yeah. What do you think that is?
Partly recognition. Partly it's ingrained culturally. Very deep level. Drip.
So, what do you think is not difficult? What do you think is not hard? What's the opposite of forgiveness?
Being hard on self.
What if we had to create a polarity between forgiveness and what would be the other end?
Revenge
and unforgiveness. And unforgiveness and revenge come so easily. And really, I agree with you, we really have to work hard to achieve forgiveness. So I'm trying to attempt to... Yeah. Is this mine? But one thing that really changed my perception of spirituality was something similar to what Marisa said. And it was written by Pierre Salar de Chardin, which says we are not human beings. We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. And that stayed with me. And that really shifted the energy, you know? Now, I know there are students around. So I'm going to mention that... healing takes place both physiologically, psychologically, and there's a whole change in this energy, shifts of energy due to hormonal changes. We have two brains, right? There's the physical brain, the anatomical brain, there's the psychological brain, and then there's the mind. And the brain is made up of the cerebral cortex, but then deep down, that's why I needed the presentation, but it doesn't matter. So imagine the brain, but deep down in the middle, there's the amygdala. Do you know what the amygdala is? Students especially. So the amygdala, there is the thalamus, which receives senses, and then we have responses, like when you smell something and you become in touch with that smell when you were young. There's hypothalamus, which feeds the pituitary, which then releases the hormones we need when we become stressed. And why does stress create illness? Yeah, because there is the release of adrenaline and other hormones, which then impinges on our body organs, which then become damaged. Right? And one thing I want to say is that every emotion gets stored in our body cells at cellular levels. It's like having mini minds at every cell, on every cell. That's why we get backaches and headaches and twitching when we are laden with emotions. Once I got a student of mine who said, "Sir, do you mind if I speak to you after the lecture?" And I said, "Yes, of course." So I spent half an hour with her. And we went into the room. And she sat down and I sat down just facing each other. But at a point, she went off tangent. I said nothing. And she kept quiet, not looking at me for quite a while. And I said, deep down I said, what am I to do? Am I to ask something or what? Then I decided to say nothing, just to be. After several minutes, she started sighing and breathing heavily. I said, oh. Then after another couple of minutes, she said, Walter, thank you. I think I can go for a coffee now. I said, can you tell me what happened? And she said, I will write you an email. A lot happened. I kept waiting for the email. The email came. And she said, you know what? In those 20 minutes,
so it was 10-20 minutes. I got in touch knowing that I was in a safe place with my pain, with my emotional pain. And the fact that I did not need to talk about it, I became aware of it. I was in touch with it. And I let it go. And I let it go. And I said, how did you do that? She said, I decided it was not worth it to keep thinking about my father who beat my mother and hurt me so much, she was saying to herself, and carry the pain of not feeling loved and the hatred and the anger, the stress release hormones, and not being able to focus on my life. So that was a turning point there. Okay, and she decided that I have a life, I need to seek the purpose, I need to move on and live and be. And the words she wrote in the email were that she was empowered, she took the power from her father onto herself, the power, the positive power, because until then she gave the power of her father to really dampen her spirit. Okay, and now she is flourishing, she's very creative, she's very intelligent, she's graduating. So that is one story. Another story from my clinical practice as a psychotherapist. This is a patient who was referred to me, a 56-year-old. I think Bana knows who the person is. And she came to me. She was referred to me for meditation. She was dying from cancer. And the first time I met this lady, she was so sweet, wearing a wig with a stick, sitting with crutches. And when she saw me, she said, I am the one. I said, oh, wow. And she came into the room, and I didn't know what to do with this lady. I prepared some things, of course, knowing that she wanted meditation. But when she came in, she said, sir, I need to let my husband who left me go. I know that my cancer is caused because of this divorce or separation. I know I have been carrying this for years. I know the cancer is created because I gave it permission, not knowingly. But now I am at a point, knowing that I'm dying, to prepare my death, for my death, for my funeral even. And then I said, so how can I help you? And she said, I want to be at peace. I want to meditate on how the funeral will be. And all I had with me, because I always carry lavender with me, the lavender oil, a candle. I always have a candle around. And I told her, would you like music? Would you like silence? You want what? No, she said, just a drop of lavender, because I cannot breathe. She had late stage cancer. And I said, okay. She was so much with me. I put a few drops of lavender. She inhaled. She closed her eyes. We just were there quietly together. And when she was again in the room, she said, I know what I want for my funeral. And that was actually, I met her only twice, because she was then back to hospital. She didn't answer my message, but then I knew she was in hospital. I asked if I could visit. I visited. She was in reverse prayer nursing. She was protected, that is. And I went in, and she said, I am going to die. Just be with me for 2 minutes. Let's close our eyes. That was it. I said nothing. She said nothing.
So we just were there for each other. And if this is not prayer, I don't know what. No? Then I left the room soon after she died. You know? So these are the things that give shivers to my skin and my hair props up, you know. But anyway, so these are experiences, some of the experiences I encountered. But going back to the healing power of forgiveness, there's a lot of research. And very 1 minute, okay. The magic is that we know that we need to tune out of our ego selves. As Jung says, we have the ego, the small self, and the big self. The big self that is so strong and has so much potential. And if we only realize that we need to just move out of the small self and acknowledge that we have a bigger self, like the student of mine, okay, then things happen and we give permission to ourselves to move on. Okay? So be still. This is all we need to do. Find a quiet space. Be still. Be in touch with yourselves. Become aware. See what evolves. And move on. Okay? I'm stopping there in case there are questions.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you also for sharing your examples that probably were not on the slides.
They were not,
more,
actually.
Yeah, more. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
So, please, if you have questions or comments.
I'm just thinking, Terry, it always boils down to presence, doesn't it?
Exactly. I fully agree.
I think if we're talking about spirituality, it's us. So how committed we need to be to our own spiritual growth.
Yeah, and how are we going to be spiritually committed? How do we do that? Student, I would like to know something about students, about your own spirit. How are you in touch with your spirituality? Because it can be a very vague concept. It's a hard concept to crunch on, as Professor Cowling said yesterday.
I think myself, I study occupational therapy. I think it kind of combines itself a lot with kind of what we're sort of being taught with the theory of everything at the moment, in terms of the meaning behind everything and what you can truly believe in. So I find it easier to get in touch with my own spirituality kind of through that. But I can see why I just sort of get a bit kind of, I don't really know what it is.
Yeah. One thing I tell you, spirituality is from the inside, it's created inside us. And it evolves to become manifested to the outside, through our relationships, etc. Another client of mine actually was healed of her hypertension through meditation. So meditation, art therapy, music therapy, breathing, these are all tools I use. They come very handy to help people who want to be in touch with their own self-forgiveness.
Okay.
Okay,
so thank you. Once again, thank you very much, Teresa.
Most of
them.
Thank you.
And I think there's a lot to reflect on, even after your examples and all. And well, things combine here,
yes,
from Benna's and your presentation, also to your how our clients or patients make us move ourselves too. Let things stay together as you showed in your model.
One question I have.
Yes.
Was it 20 minutes I was allowed?
In trouble, yes.
It passed so quickly.
How
I never realized.
Students are really processed from
inside.
So now we have the pleasure also to
welcome
Dr. Karen Chance, and you will present yourself to us.
I would like to greet you all. I'm coming from Switzerland, and I'm also a psychotherapist, but I'm working and also a theologian and chaplain, and I'm talking now about my experience and my research as a chaplain in a hospital, but also a pastor going visiting people at home. And in the hospital there is a palliative care unit, and we have several chaplains together have a 24-hour spiritual care service, which means that I'm called often in the middle of the night or whenever to people because they have a spiritual need. So it has a lot to do with my experience there, and I'm very honored to present here. I know today I'm now talking to the converted, but I would like to say a few things that you already know. I think a lot of what I'm saying you already know. Lessons taught by dying people that life is precious. And I experience again and again that the imminence of death, when it is in front of your nose, that changes a lot. That's a force, a power. And then something happens. Priorities change, and there is fear of the unknown, and that can be causing a lot of conflict, and it can be very oppressive. And then it's very important that people are there. And the one thing where I would like to get at today in this small talk is that faith matters, which I experience again and again. Here quickly the different dimensions when people die is on the one hand the physical dimension, everything to do with the body, and then the psychosocial and spiritual dimension. And there you can say heart, mind, spirit, soul. And the professor of palliative medicine at the University of Lausanne, Borasio, wrote a bestseller, and he says that the two are about 50-50. I mean, the processes and what is happening, the body and the attention necessary and needed about medical and nursing about 50 for the body, and psychosocial and spiritual about 50. However, the distressing symptoms of the body that are causing fear and pain, of course that's first priority, always. And to be in very good medical care gives security. And we all need that, especially when we are dying or something happens to us and to our body. But then what happens, there is a confusion of the symptoms. They look physical, they look all like symptoms of the body, but there are a lot of emotional, mental and spiritual, a lot of emotional, mental and spiritual pain is causing symptoms that look as if it was only physical. And I've spoken with many palliative care medicines, doctors, and also with nurses, and they say that sometimes when a person is in panic, is in great fear, the doctors give what they can, which is more medicine to relieve the distress, to calm them down, to take away the fear and so on. And sometimes the dosage is so high that they don't understand anymore why it doesn't help. And I'm now talking to a lot of psychologists. It's clear there is so much else happening, the other 50%, and sometimes the care of the body takes over. Also, with dying people, that is in the center focus, and it is important not to forget or to give a lot of attention to the other symptoms or the other processes. So here I'm talking about the heart, then also the mind and the soul, heart, mind, spirit, soul. And there a lot goes within each other. It's hard to say this is only the emotional, this is only spiritual, this is only social or psychological. It's hard, it is flowing. So important now in terms of relationships is who is there in my life, who is there for me right now, who can I trust? It was already said today, trust is so important. And who do I love and who really loves me? And they are the most important people at my side. But then, almost as important is the question, with whom am I in conflict? Or where is distance? Where is hurt? And also, often, with blind people, there are people, there are experiences coming up, people from the past. Sometimes when children have been abused, it was a secret for the whole life. And interestingly enough, before in that dying process, it comes up. It hurts. There is the grief and all this comes up then. And they could put it down for decades and now they don't want to anymore and they cannot. And there a little example, I was called at 3 in the morning to a big hospital as a chaplain, and there was a lady, she was about 55, she had a big operation, heart operation the next day, the chances were 50-50, you know, the risk was 50-50, and she couldn't sleep. She said to the nurse, I need a chaplain now. And so when I was there, she started talking, and then what came out is that she, before she got married, had a child and gave it away for adoption and never told anybody. It was her big secret, and never, she could have, but never made contact, you know, with that child, even though she knew that she knew where she was. And that was so much on her heart, and she wanted to tell somebody, and then also ask for forgiveness between her and God. It was on her soul. And we had a prayer and a blessing, and she said, if I survive this, I'm going to tell. And I'm going to make contact. Like, it was like something that was not finished. And this saying goodbye, the mourning, the coping with grief, and then always the meaning. What is the meaning of all this? And also the making peace with others, and we just heard it with myself, which is one of the very hardest thing to do at all. Like, we are the hardest on ourselves, to forgive ourselves. And there we hold on so long. And then also making peace with God. Then mind and spirit, the mental processes, the existential and spiritual questions, there it is a difference if we are not dying or if we are this close before our own death. If we are not dying, we can philosophize, we can theologize, we can discuss for nights, who am I? Where do I come from? Where do I go to? What is the meaning of life? That's the subject of philosophy, theology, psychology a lot. Anyway, and it can be very theoretical, very interesting. And if you ask a theologian, I'm one of them, then they often don't say just one sentence, one answer. No. For every one of these questions, you can look at it this way or that way, and there is this position, and the other position, right? It's not just one short answer. But now, when it becomes existential, and then it always is also spiritual, it's a different story. Again, an example. My colleague, a chaplain, was called to a man, also in a hospital, who had a very bad accident, and he fell from a great height, And he had inner bleeding and inner hurt. He was inside wounded, and he was a bleeder. That is a person, when he bleeds, the blood doesn't stop the natural way. Okay.
Hemophilia.
Yeah, I needed that word. Thank you. Okay, and they operated on him about 3 hours. He was only 36. He had a family. Everything, they did everything they could, but they could not save him. But they could stop a bit. And so he was told by the doctor, you have 72 hours. I mean, my colleague heard this and he was just shaking. And even when he told us this, it's such an incredible situation that you... And there you cannot give... Okay, there is... Anyway, I get ahead of myself. He was then called, after he told his closest family members, the next thing he did is he called the chaplain. He was a Catholic. And when the chaplain was there, my colleague, he said, I need to know what comes after. I want to know what I can hold on to, what I can believe, what is real. I not want to know now what is afterwards. When I have died, what comes then? He didn't ask if is there a God, but how will that be? And so there, that was existential. And the colleague couldn't give a theoretical question. And he talked about, he needed to do use of self. You cannot go otherwise. He needed to also say what he believes and how he sees it. Otherwise it's theoretical. And that was then a satisfying question. And there are many images in the Bible that are wonderful of what comes afterwards. For example, one is that it is a wedding reception. The kingdom of God is like a wedding reception. Another one is the description of the garden. The third one is that there are different places for different people. And of course, the important one in the Christian faith, and I'm now speaking today or coming from a Christian perspective, is the resurrection, the new life, the changed, transformed life afterwards. So, just to say that it is a big difference where you're coming from. And then there are the emotional and existential spiritual processes that we need, again, for the dying, we need to find some kind of answers for that. We can try to avoid it, but these questions come again and again. It's like looking back on your life. What was the joy of my life? What broke my spirit? Where did I succeed? Where am I proud and happy? Where did I fail? What is left unfinished? Who received my love? And who gave me love? Then the psychosocial and spiritual pain, you know that, again, are the existential questions, the unfinished business, the grief, the hurtful relationships, the experience and conviction of not being loved, respected and cared for. That's again the low self-esteem. The loneliness, the hopelessness and despair, and a state of being without peace. And I heard of this reflective journal of the students. There is a lot of those questions are in there, and also the hopelessness sometimes and the despair. But then, when life has lived maybe full of work and full of busyness, and then suddenly death comes way too early, then people are not prepared for this. They haven't taken that time for meditation or for stillness or of to ask themselves what happens. Now, the faith at the end of life, and this is now a point that is important for me. So often when I go into a room, I hear they are not religious, they don't have a church affiliation, or if they do, it's not so important for them, and they are not very spiritual. And then family, friends, doctors and nurses and other health professionals tell me the same thing. And sometimes they tell me there is no need for spiritual care and not no need for me as a chaplain. And I used to believe it. I used to believe them, and then I discovered that there is much more faith than people say or even know. I'm talking now about the dying. Before, it's a different story. But in crisis, it's not just with dying people, also people that go through very, very hard times. When you're sort of raw, and also in crisis. And others, they say they wish they could have faith in those times. Now, about faith, I hear it over and over. Faith is so personal. It's intimate. We talk more about sex than about faith. Faith meaning my personal faith. We can talk about almost everything else, but personal faith, that's like coming out, that's like saying who we are. Except if we are nicely grounded in a church or another religious community, then it's different. Among those people, when we sing and pray together, then people can talk about it. But when you are in society, then it's different. But faith, and often people don't have a language to describe it. They cannot even ask faith questions, spiritual questions, because sometimes they don't even discern that what is happening inside is actually a spiritual question. And then faith has roots in their childhood, and with and there is sometimes some shame because it's so simple, and then they say as an adult I cannot really believe, and they are torn back and forth, but it develops and it transcends. Now about the hope, I was already talking about the hope. There again, it has images, it has it is quite specific, only saying to a dying person all will be fine, that's not hope that carries, that gives you strength. And in the concerning spiritual resources, the hope is again something that fits with what you have been taught, with what you believe now, with what you reflect, and then carries you. And now to the last point, in the end, it is that forgiveness, that love that comes with the forgiveness, with the acceptance, whether it is with people or with that I can forgive myself, and also the experience of being loved and being precious and being important by God. That is then the liberating, or can be the liberating experience, that then the love is the one thing that like transcends, that helps to endure what comes, what we have to go through, what we don't know how it will be exactly, and to be there safe, to trust in faith. The body is not safe. It doesn't feel safe anymore, but to know that we have a place where we are safe. And then to be able to trust that safety and to accept it without having to work for it or do anything for it, but being able to say yes to such a love. Okay, I would like to stop here.
Thank you very much. Yep. Also for both your sharing and also your reflection on your experience which you shared with us. Maybe there are, again, questions, comments?
Yes?
I wonder about the positive effect of doubt.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm feeling is doubt is personal too. I wondered if you had any thoughts or reflections on that from your experience.
I think when so many that I see, they are full of doubt. And sometimes they say, I have a little tiny bit of faith and so much doubt, but I would like to, I need now also faith, and then to be able to say doubt is part of faith and is also human, and they almost belong together, I think. And then to also show examples of people that doubted a lot and yet had a strong faith, and that's important that the two can be together.
Thank you.
Yeah?
I'm Jackie Watts, thank you very much. It was really interesting. On one of your slides you noted a series of points relating to coming to the end of life, where you said who I loved, what I achieved. There were a list of
this one.
That's it. Yeah. Some of that, I think, I don't know what you think, is almost akin to a life review.
Yes, exactly.
I suppose.
Yeah.
And there is some work that's been done in Japan mm-hmm. by Ando, A-N-D-O, and colleagues, about the impact of life review mm-hmm. on patients who are terminally ill with cancer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I've come across this work. Mm-hmm. And what came out of that mm-hmm. is that, in fact, the process of life review, whether that's initiated mm-hmm. in a semi-formal way by a clinician or a social worker, that can be a two-edged sword. Because on the one hand, it can really enable really positive reflections and connections. Mm-hmm. But on the other, it can emphasize what has not been.
Yeah.
And I currently am supporting someone mm-hmm. who I think is coming to the end of his life. And I dare not initiate any kind. I've been with him all his life. He's 67. I dare not initiate any kind of reflection, because what I see is a terrible life. Really. And I was thinking how awful that can be. Maybe I'm not expressing it well. It's only because I left his bedside to come here, and when I go back, mm-hmm. I don't know whether he'll be alive or not, but he's terribly, terribly ill. But I've been thinking about this all the time, mm-hmm. as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So this slide prompted that. What do you think about that? Because that can leave a person feeling worse.
Yeah, yes. My experience has been that at the end of life there is no time for psychotherapy or for, you know, at all. But when people come to you and they say very specific things that are on their mind, then now again, talking as a chaplain, that there is the possibility to that they can talk about it and realize how hurtful it was in their life, and then maybe also bring it before God and ask for forgiveness in prayer. So that is one thing. and it is very specific. The other thing is that often people went a terrible life. There have been so many things, you cannot name them, and there to find some kind of peace before dying is also very important. And sometimes people can do it by surrendering, by taking some of the goodness and accepting that as a whole. Sometimes, again, from the Christian perspective, just praying the Our Father is extremely important, that they did not have peace at all and they were in such an upheaval inside, and they didn't want prayer and they didn't want things during the whole process because of such a terrible life. And when they sometimes allow that prayer at the end, I have seen it then, sometimes it's this surrender, there's no other word. Because you cannot again do work. And you cannot change it, but then sort of to give themselves into it, and the faith changes, and then they can let go in some way.
They can't change it, but maybe they can change the present moment. So I'm thinking, what if we can use some positive affirmations there and then, and say that I love myself even though.
Yes.
And rest in peace.
Yes.
What I do is, first of all, use immediacy within the relationship. So I could say, how I am feeling. I can say, I'm feeling very warm towards you, that you are trusting me with this. So, as you're saying, there's no time to change their life. But we can also point out things which they're not aware of. Because if they say, look, my life is wasted, that's one thing. But if I'm saying, I'm using my relationship with the client and saying, thank you for trusting me, I'm feeling very warm towards you. Or else, maybe pick up something in their life which was positive. I like working with families very much, and I'm saying, oh my God, your daughter really loves you. You must have given her so much love. And that could be enough. So it's either pointing out things they're not seeing in their lives. I don't think it can be totally a failure. There must be something positive. And also using the relationship, using the immediacy of the relationship. So that would be the present as well.
That is now sort of for this dimension to the others, other human beings. But then when there is a terrible life, it obstructs the relationship to God. And that's where the other dimension comes in. Where often people cannot die because they are at war, or maybe not at war, but they can't accept a terrible life. And there also, at some point, if you can, it makes a huge difference.
Do you have something equivalent to our confession?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
Our sacrament of reconciliation.
Yes. And
I find very healing.
In the Swiss Reformed Church, where I come from, there is not really the confession, but people call and they confess. But then it is not giving the absolution, but it is giving the confirmation of what God has said, His will. You know, it's not saying, I forgive you, but I pray for this and God has said this. Okay. Thank you very much.